the common denominator of tamei situations is contact with death. That the rule is contact with death in many, many forms confers on a person the status of being tamei. Now, what is that status of being tamei? He's Jewish, he does mitzvot, he keeps Shabbat, but he's ostracized from the environs of the Beit HaMikdash and participation in the sacrificial rites until he engages in rituals that make him tahor. So the difference between a tamei person and a tahor person is limited almost exclusively to whether or not a person could enter Beit HaMikdash. Meaning in everyday life, there'll be very, very little difference. And what makes a person tamei? Contact with death. So let's enumerate some of the most common examples of what makes a person tamei. I touch a dead body. I am in a cemetery in which the dead are buried. I'm in a room which is under the same roof as a dead body. Because even if I don't touch it, the mace is over there and I'm over here, I am tamei. Touching dead animals can make a person tamei, unless the animal was properly shechted. I mean, the animal that is shechted in a kosher manner is not tamei.
You touch the chicken, right.
When you eat meat, you don't become tamei, even though it's a dead animal. On the other hand, it's very interesting. People don't realize, if you touch a piece of non-kosher meat, which was not shechted properly, that can actually make you tamei. Now, of course, we're all tamei anyway for reasons I'll describe in a moment. But all of these things are tamei, meaning a person who touches this or moves this would not be allowed to enter the temple unless they engaged in a purification ritual. Now, the difference is, if you touch a human body or you're under the same roof as a human body, you are tamei for 7 days. If you touch a dead animal that was not shechted, you're only tamei for 1 day. So there are differences in the concept of tumah, but there is a notion of being tamei. Now, let's a few other examples. It's very interesting that you see from this the following, that tumah, which represents a void or an absence that is generated by the loss of life, the greater the life, the greater the void that is created. That is why the tumah of a human corpse is halachically more strict than the tumah of an animal. If I touch a dead animal, I am only tamei for 1 day. If I touch a dead human being, or I'm under the same roof as a dead human being, I am tamei for 7 days. Why is there a difference? Because tumah represents the absence and the emptiness that is generated when life is no longer present. The more significant the life, the more holy the life, the greater is the void and the emptiness, that the aching gap, the abyss, that is created when that life leaves. And therefore, ironically, tumah is directly correlated the holiness and sanctity of the existence that has been vacated. That is why it is even true that the tumah of a non-Jewish corpse is not quite as severe as the tumah of a Jewish corpse. Now again, Rav Yehuda Halevi, this is a halacha, Rav Yehuda Halevi, who of course emphatically talks about the superiority of the Jewish soul many, many times, and this is a bit one of his controversial teachings, would certainly endorse this, and he would understand this, because he would basically say that the Jewish soul, which possessed greater sanctity and holiness, creates greater tumah when it withdraws than the non-Jewish soul. Now, specifically, I'm going to pinpoint this halachically, let me explain this, because this has actually halachic importance. A non-Jewish met, a non-Jewish corpse, only conveys tumah if you directly touch it or move it. But if you're in the same room or in the cemetery, it does not convey the tumah. A Jewish corpse conveys tumah even if you walk through a cemetery and the like. This has some interesting historical implications. You may recall, if you have been in Jerusalem, you may recall that on the other side well, the, what's called the Golden Gate. That is the gate that is facing the Mount of Olives, which is a closed-up gate that is not used. There is an Arab cemetery that goes right up to the Golden Gate, right on that little hill going down until the valley of Yehoshaphat, which then goes up to the Mount of Olives. The Mount of Olives is already a Jewish cemetery, although that's been desecrated, but there's a little Arab cemetery right up there. And there is a story. The Arabs are very attuned to Midrashim. At least the older Arabs knew the Midrashim. And there is a Midrash that the Eliyahu HaNavi will announce the coming of the Mashiach. He will come from the Mount of Olives, go down the valley of Yehoshaphat, and go through the Golden Gate, which will first enter Templeground, and will announce the coming of the Mashiach. There is a rabbinic tradition that Eliyahu HaNavi is actually a reincarnation of an earlier biblical figure, Pinchas. Aaron's, the grandchild, Pinchas the Kohen. We know that a Kohen is not allowed to become Tameh. See, we're allowed to become Tameh. We are Tameh, but we're allowed to. A Kohen cannot become Tameh. So they figured, if we put a cemetery right up at the Golden Gate, Eliyahu HaNavi will not be able to announce the coming of the Mashiach. So the Jews will not have their Redeemer. And if the Jews will not have their Redeemer, so that's fine. We'll remain in custody of the Har HaBayit, the Temple Mount, and the Beit HaMikdash. Their mistake, well, that's pretty good. That's a pretty good argument. Although I would assume that Mashiach will find other ways. In other words, their argument is, if Eliyahu HaNavi cannot announce the Mashiach, Mashiach can't come. Well, first of all, Hashem can find other ways, you know. Second of all, who says this? Is Hashem going to say it has to be through the Mount of Olives or there won't be a redemption? Or Hashem will find the alternative route? You know, I mean, there are many, many routes. But the other reason, the final reason why this isn't valid, is that if the corpses that are buried there are non-Jewish corpses, they convey Tumah only through direct touching and moving. They do not convey Tumah by simply walking through the cemetery. So as a result, Eliyahu HaNavi will be allowed to enter that gate and announce the coming of the Mashiach. So, but once again, Rabbi Halevi explains that the law of Tumah, the abyss, the emptiness, the void that is created when a life departs, is a direct function to the holiness and beauty that it had when it was present. And that is why, yes, there is Tumah when an animal dies as well, because animals have a function in the world. Animals are both a utilitarian function and even an affectionate function, right? I mean, when people come and they're grieving because their dog died, it's not something to laugh over. You know, again, I mean, obviously a dog is not a human being, and one should not grieve for an animal more than one grieves for a human being, but that a certain amount of attachment is there is undoubtedly a reality that one needs to consider. So dogs, cats, animals, when they die, there is a void. But the void is not that of a human being, of holiness and sanctity. So the Tumah is less. A non-Jewish soul is capable of much more holiness and goodness. So the Tumah is 7 days, but only if you directly touch it or move it. The vacation, the vacating of a Jewish soul, which is the greatest void and the greatest emptiness, has the highest level of Tumah. It's a Tumah of 7 days, but not only if you touch it or move it, but even if you're in the same room or in the cemetery or the like. Now keep in mind that the concept that contact with the dead makes you Tamei, that's not only for a Kohen. A Kohen is the only one that is not allowed to make themselves Tamei. But the concept of Tamei applies to a Kohen, men, women, anything. In other words, you are Tamei, contact with the dead.
Aren't there situations where contact with the dead doesn't
make you Tamei? What thing are you thinking of? No, that's not at all. Again, don't confuse two things. There's no question that the Chevra Kadisha is doing the greatest mitzvah of taking care of the dead. That's a sort of mitzvah. But it doesn't remove the Tumah. One is Tameh. One is Tameh for justifiable reasons. Meaning, if you buried the dead as part of the Chevra Kadisha, you still would not be allowed to go into the temple for 7 days. In other words, the mitzvah that you're doing doesn't change the fact that there is Tumah. Tumah is a fact. Whether it's
carry on with your activities that
Yeah, but that's that's my whole point. My whole point is that the status of Tumah doesn't really stop you from doing anything other than entering into the temple. Meaning, there is no disability. People have to understand this. Because when we say the word impure, that connotes a notion of quarantine. That connotes a notion of ostracizing. That's not true. Tumah does involve an ostracizing, but in the only very limited sense of you may not enter the temple. You may not eat the korbanot. You may not perform the sacrificial rites if you're a kohen. But in terms of everything else, going to shul, davening, keeping the holidays, of course you do that, just because you're tamei. That does not absolve you of anything. So we have to understand, therefore, that tumah does come from contact with death. We'll elaborate on this shortly. But it is a construct that is almost exclusively concerned with disabilities pertaining to the Beit HaMikdash, the Korbanot, and the like. And therefore, when there's no Beit HaMikdash, although a Kohen is not allowed to make himself Tameh, but other than that, whether I'm Tameh or Tahor makes no difference to my daily life. I will do the same things if I'm Tameh or I'm Tahor. And in fact, all of us in this room are Tameh. We are Tameh for the following reason. When I said that when you're in contact with a dead body, you're Tameh for 7 days, that presupposes you engage in purification rituals. Now, one of the important purification rituals that make a person from Tamei to Tahor is to be sprinkled with the ashes of the red heifer, which we'll describe. Given the fact that we don't have that ritual, then any human being who has ever been in a cemetery or who has shaken the hand of somebody who's been in a cemetery is Tamei, and there's literally no possible way to extricate yourself from Tumah until we have the restoration of the Para Aduma, you see? And therefore, that is why, for example, when you go to the Kotel, the Western Wall, is actually not a wall of the temple, per se, but it is the wall of the Temple Mounts. The temple would be further in. But the Halakha, you'll notice that the Jews who observe Halakha do not go beyond. They do not, although it is possible to visit the mosque beyond the temple wall, beyond the Kotel wall, religious Jews do not go beyond that wall. And the reason is very simple. Because beyond that wall is the beginning of the temple premises. And one who is in a state of Tumah is not allowed to walk on the temple grounds. And since all of us are in a state of Tumah, because if we have come in contact with the dead any time in our life, we have not become purified by the ashes of the Para Adumah, so consequently, a Tameh person is not allowed to enter the temple. Now, the government doesn't stop you from doing that. In other words, the government, if you want to go, no one's going to stop you. But according to Halakha, one is not allowed to go because one is in a state of Tumah. But as I say, other than that, what difference does it make in our lives, right? In other words, it doesn't stop you. And the point I'm making is, you are Tameh whether your contact was justifiable or not. Meaning, even if your contact with the dead was the greatest possible mitzvah, the greatest possible mitzvah, go ahead and do it, Baruch Hashem. But it doesn't change the fact that one is Tameh. It's an automatic consequence of contact with the dead. Justification or lack of does not enter into the picture. By the way, that's why there are some opinions that actually say that a Kohen, we don't rule this way, a Kohen today is allowed to go into a cemetery because since he's already Tameh, going into a cemetery is not going to make him more Tameh. There is such an opinion. We don't rule that way because we rule that every new thing is a new thing. In other words, even though he's Tameh, because he shook somebody's hand once, but he should not increase the Tumah by going in. Right? But there is such an opinion. The opinion of Avram ben David, the Maimonides' great antagonist, who actually rules that because every Kohen is already Tameh today, there would be no additional prohibition. Now, this comes up, by the way, in a lot of issues. The Kohen, now again, we have to differentiate between the fact of being Tameh and the prohibition, meaning a non-Kohen will become Tameh, but he's allowed to become Tameh. A Kohen is not even supposed, is not allowed to enter into a cemetery or contact with the dead, which raises a very serious problem, I don't want to get into it too much, about whether a Kohen can be a medical student. Because part of, now once the Kohen is a doctor, let me explain this, if a Kohen is a doctor, there tends to be less of a problem, because obviously if he needs to treat patients who might die, so even though he's coming in contact with the dead, or potentially dead, he's allowed to do so to help the living. So the issue is not so much, can a Kohen practice medicine? That's not so much of a problem. But there's a very serious problem, is a Kohen allowed to train to practice medicine? Because he's not yet a doctor. And part of medical training does involve sometimes working with cadavers and the like. And even though now they have some very, very beautiful computer-generated models. In fact, there's a whole discussion, because there was a shortage of cadavers anyway, because fewer people are leaving their bodies to science, which Allah example is exactly welcome, because leaving your body to general anatomy is not considered that proper. It ought to be buried. But be it as it may, because of the shortage of cadavers and the development of computer technology, some people are actually suggesting that there might be less of a need to work on an actual human body. On the other hand, other people say, no, the doctor needs, you know, to see the feel of an actual body. That's how you perform surgery. That's how you learn where things are, which, you know, at some level makes sense. But certainly, the problem is, if a Kohen is not allowed to become tamei to a dead body, the question is a Kohen allowed to study medicine? It's one thing to say, once I'm a doctor, I can enter hospitals because I may have to save somebody's life, but can I train for that if I have a choice of different professions? So the truth is, it's a whole discussion. Again, one should ask their rabbi if this is a practical issue. But nevertheless, most poskim, most rabbinic decisors, actually rule that a Kohen should be strongly discouraged from pursuing on the undergraduate and graduate level medical training. Meaning, if you're already a doctor, we can find ways of working, but that should not be the choice of career for a Kohen. And that would even be a problem if a Kohen wants to be a psychiatrist, because as you know, a psychiatrist goes through a general medical education first, and you might even say it's less justifiable, because if I'm going to be a heart surgeon, so it's part of my job to train. If I'm going to be a psychiatrist, I don't really have to know heart surgery that much, so there might even be less of a justification there. So if a Kohen wants to be a psychiatrist, we should steer him to be a psychologist, mm-hmm. and then he could avoid that issue.
If the tumor is based on the level of the holiness void
that was there,
and therefore a Jew has more than a non-Jew, which has more than an animal.
That's correct.
Why doesn't it work the other way around? Why doesn't coming into contact with a kohen have even more restrictions?
That's an interesting. In other words, the corpse of a Kohen should convey more tuma than the corpse of a Yisrael. And that's a good question. I don't know exactly. Obviously, it's not a consistent matter. Because Kohen and Yisrael are really part of the same nation. They have the same soul. It doesn't seem to be a qualitatively different soul. Again, if you remember weeks ago, we had a discussion that one of the controversial teachings of the Kuzari, which, again, some people get upset sometimes, was he openly states, his position is, he openly states the superiority of the Jewish soul. This is one of the Yudha Levi's teachings, which some, have trouble with in an egalitarian society, but he openly says the Jewish soul is a spiritually holier entity. But of course, keep in mind, I think I gave you a mashal, that maybe one way we can understand this is in terms of gas tanks, kind of using a very folksy mashal. Let's assume that the Jewish soul is a 20-gallon tank, and the non-Jewish soul is only a 10-gallon tank. Let's make an assumption of numbers. And let's assume the non-Jewish soul has 10 gallons of gas in it, and the Jewish soul only has 2 gallons of gas in it. So it might very well be that the potentialities for holiness are greater for the Jewish soul than the non-Jewish soul. But in terms of how much of that potential was realized by the goodness that one did in one's life, it may equally be true that there may be many, many non-Jews who are more righteous and holy than many Jews, simply because they have actualized more of their potential than the Jewish soul. So the 20-gallon tank that only has 1 gallon in it is obviously not going to take you as far as the 10-gallon tank that has 10 gallons in it. So I think one way of, because a lot of times people have the problem, this is so unfair because I know so-and-so is such a righteous, good, kind person, how can you say that they're inferior to this guy that, you know, is a very disgusting person? The answer is, the tanks might be different, but indeed, the non-Jew may indeed have more holiness in his life by virtue of the gas that he's put in. Okay, so so I think this maybe make Rita Levi a bit more acceptable, at least to our contemporary understanding, in the sense that Rita Levi is talking about potentials for holiness. But whether a potential for holiness is realized is a function of the virtuous choices that human beings make. And of course, Rita Levi admits that Jews do not always make virtuous choices. And in that sense, the potential for holiness, which is there, is not actualized. And in fact, there's another teacher of Rita Levi that almost makes this point explicitly, because he makes the following point. He makes the point, which connects to Tumah as well, that the more holiness there is when a potential is realized, the more degradation there is when that potential is not realized. The example, a dead plant is not as repulsive as a dead animal. And a dead plant is not going to stink as much as a dead animal, because the potential of the plant, in terms of its holiness or whatever it is less than the animal soul. A dead corpse, a human corpse, putrefies. It's generally worse than even an animal. So the point is, the greater the potential, the greater the desecration. Therefore, he makes the point. In his hierarchy, again, this is Rabbi Dalevi, not me speaking. In his hierarchy, he says, the medieval philosophers divided life into four groups. There is what is called the domem, which is the inanimate, like a rock or a mineral. There is the tzomeach, the vegetative. There is the chai, which is the animal. And then the fourth level is midaber, the speaker, which is the human being. And Rav Yehuda Halevi argues very strenuously, as all the medieval philosophers argue, that man is not just an animal, just like the difference between the inanimate and the vegetative is a different level of existence. And the vegetative and the animal is a different level of existence. So too, animal and human is a qualitatively different level of existence. And then Rav Yehuda Halevi posits there is a fifth level of existence. That is Yisrael, the Jewish soul. And in his position, which is a radical position, the difference between a Jewish soul and a non-Jewish soul is qualitatively as great as the difference between a non-Jewish soul and an animal soul. Because he actually considers this a fifth level of existence. However, then keep in mind the correlative proposition of this. That is, just as the animal soul that departs creates a putrefaction and a disgust that is greater than the departing of the plant soul, so to speak, so too, when a Jew fails to live up to the potentialities of the Jewish soul, there may be an ugliness that is even greater than the non-Jew that fails to live up to his destiny. So this goes back to the idea that the concept of the chosen people is primarily an issue of being chosen for responsibility and obligation, and not chosen for privilege. And when those responsibilities are not lived up to, the void can be ugly and can be even more disgusting and repulsive than the non-Jew that failed. Right? So keep in mind that on one hand, if one would describe Rav Yehuda Halevi as a triumphalist, meaning kind of trumping the superiority of the Jewish soul, it is always with a very acute awareness of the awesome responsibilities that attach to that particular designation. Meaning, it's not a free ride. Rav Yehuda Halevi will be the last person in the world that will say that, you know, every Jew, no matter how disgusting his behavior, is better than any non-Jew, no matter how noble their behavior. It's exactly not that point. He's talking about potentialities, he's talking about gas tanks, and he makes the point that the Jew who does not live according to his destiny would be inferior to even the guy who does not live according to their destiny. Right? So it's always a question of responsibility and focus. But be it as it may, this is reflected halachically in the laws of Tumah. That's very interesting. This is a very interesting problem, which there are some Sephardim actually who are leaning to this. There is a statement in the Talmud that says, Tzadikim never really die. Tzadikim, the righteous, are eternally alive. And based on this, there were some opinions that say, even a Kohen is allowed to walk to the grave site of a righteous person, because that Tzadik does not die. Of course, he has to be careful not to walk by any other graves, etc. However, that is not accepted halachically at all. Halachically, that just refers to the spirituality of the soul surviving, but the body itself, according to virtually all, not there are some things, as you say, but the halacha is very clear that it's forbidden. So we do consider two, and in fact, according to this explanation, there specifically should be tumah for the tzaddik, because the void that is created is a greater void.
We read currently in our lives about, in the paper, statements in which non-Jews say the Jews think they're better than everyone else, and so on and so
yes.
forth. And we answer that by speaking about the greater responsibility that was
yes.
given on Sinai.
Mm-hmm.
But is it possible that these people who make these comments know about the ladies?
Well,
this is another level.
It might be so, but once again, I mean, there are certain ideas that get out there. I believe Thomas Jefferson. I once saw a reproduction of an entry from one of Thomas Jefferson's diaries, and he made references to that he had been studying the Kuzari lately. You know, so who knows? I don't know what language he was studying. I guess Hebrew. He was studying Hebrew. You know, so. Actually now Jefferson has this thing with Sally Hemings on TV, so it's a whole other issue. But I remember John F. Kennedy said, John F. Kennedy once had a bunch of Nobel laureates over into the White House. And he said, this is the greatest collection of minds they have ever been in the White House since Thomas Jefferson had supper alone. But, you know, so, right? Yeah. There is an interpretation of some, which is not the rabbinic interpretation, that the Kohen's role in determining leprosy and contagion was really a question of quarantine because of contagious diseases. And therefore the Kohen was kind of the medical role. Although I would think it would be quite peculiar, on one hand, to assign medical responsibilities to Kohanim and then say they can't come in contact with the dead. That would almost seem to be impossible. How can you tell somebody, be a doctor, but don't hang around when they die? I mean, so there is such an interpretation, but as I say, it's not accepted. I love it.
So a Kohen...
Here's the thing. I mean, as you know, the main rabbi in Carmel, Rabbi Enbers, is a Kohen, and he's been a rabbi for many, many years. And one of the issues is, can a Kohen enter a hospital to visit someone? So here the halakha basically says that the Kohen is not obligated to assume that there is a dead body there. No, there's a dead body in the morgue, but it's not the same room, etc. So, if he knew there would be, a dead body on the floor or whatever it is, he would not be allowed to go in. But he doesn't have to make that assumption. Basically, it would have to be on the floor. So the fact that there are dead bodies in the morgue would tend not to be a problem. It's a complicated issue because if the refrigerator in which the bodies are kept is a metal refrigerator, a metal is something that is susceptible to tumah, and that which is susceptible to tumah is not a break, right? So it gets into very technical questions because maybe the refrigerator is lined with something or some other material, So it's a very complicated thing. The same as you on an airplane, right? The whole shaila. Many flights to Israel, unfortunately, often have bodies that are actually in cargo to be carried for a funeral. And the question becomes, can a Kohen be on an airplane which has a dead body? If I'm a Kohen and I'm traveling to Israel, do I have to investigate? That's a whole question. whether the cargo hold is a separate roof and therefore it was not going to the main, and that depends on the material of the floor and everything else. Of course, there's even another question. I'll tell you this question. Because the halakha is that if you walk through a cemetery, you're tameh, even if you don't touch any dead bodies. Now, there's airspace here. The airspace above the cemetery, going over that airspace makes you tameh. So here's the question. A kohen goes on a flight. If the flight flies over a cemetery at 35,000 feet, the question becomes, is the kohen making himself tameh, right? Or does he assume that the roof doesn't directly go over a cemetery? Right, so there are a lot of particular questions. Yeah. Yes. Okay. Well, that's right. But I will get to it because really my purpose of this is not so much to go over all the halachot, although I do think it's helpful just to know exactly what it is we're talking about. But I do want to talk about the philosophical issues of tameh and tahor. I will get to that at great length. All right. So now we understand the concept that tameh. Yeah. Would you agree? No. Airspace is only directly up. No. Not lateral. No. Not lateral. Although I will tell you a problem, and this was a problem that was even in Washington. If you have a tree that goes over both the grave and a highway, that's a common roof between a grave and a person on the other side. So if I'm a Kohen driving in a car that passes under a tree that overshadows both the grave and that, in fact, I become Tamei because I'm under the same roof with a corpse, right? So I even saw a letter. The rabbis had written a letter to the management of King David Cemetery, that they have to trim some of their trees. This was an issue in Israel. In Israel, as you know, one of the things that the Jordanians did during the 19 years of occupation between 48 and 67 was they desecrated large parts of the Mount of Olives Cemetery, and they made it the road. They paved the road, and consequently, even today, under certain parts of the road, there are corpses buried under the road. And there are signs in Israel. Kohanim are not allowed to travel on this road. There are detours for Kohanim. So these are actual things that still exist.
Well, what
is
the time of the
Which one? The airplane? With the body in the plane or flying over?
No, but there's a great possibility that it's
Well, one should try to find out. A Kohen should not fly on a flight that he knows there's a dead body. If he doesn't know, he's allowed to be the dead body. If he doesn't know, but he should try to find out. Sometimes you can't find out until you know. If you know, a Kohen should not. By the way, this doesn't apply to a Kohenet. It does not apply to a female Kohen, only to a Okay, so now again though, so going over those things that the Torah describes as tameh, we have of course the dead body, we have the dead animal, but then there are some less obvious cases of tameh, which are not connected directly to death, but they're connected indirectly to death. An example would be shichvat zera. The man has a seminal emission. He is tameh for only one day. Why is that? Because once again, a seminal emission is, as it were, the destruction of a potential for life that could have been generated. So even potentiality is enough here. A woman that's a nida, when a woman has her menstrual period every month, she is described as temeah. She is ritually temeah. She cannot enter the temple. Why? Once again, and that's for 7 days. Once again, the shedding of a uterine lining, which would have sustained a pregnancy, would have given the nourishment to a fertilized ovum, represents a form of death. Not of actual death, but similar to seminal emission in the sense of a life that could have come to pass. I don't know. Again, I cannot give you a comprehensive explanation for this, but it is. And in fact, we will see another thing about Nida. Nida is a bit peculiar, which is also a point that Yehuda Levi makes, although he doesn't fully answer it. Because keep in mind the following. The construct of Tuma normally means you can't go into the temple. So, if I touch a dead body, can't go into the temple. Seminal emission, can't go into the temple. Touch a dead animal, can't go into the temple. Right? Nida cannot go into the temple. Now, there's normally Tuma merely means don't go into the temple, don't bring korbanot. But every other aspect of your life is not affected by Tuma. A person who went into a cemetery is allowed to have relations with his spouse. Nida is a very, very unique. Nida is an absolutely unique extension of the law of Tuma, because the Nida is not only Tameya in the sense of every other contact with death, meaning can't go into the temple, cannot eat korbanot, but as we, and of course that doesn't apply today because we don't have that, but the law of Nida that does apply today is very much alive. That is, for that period of time, the man and wife are not allowed to have marital intimacy. And the question becomes, what does that have to do with Tuma? That is not what Tuma normally means. You see? In other words, it's very interesting. It's as if the primary meaning of Tuma is replaced by some other concept. Rabbi Yehuda Levi simply answers the following. He doesn't give an answer, but he gives you a construct. His answer is that in Nida, there are two things that occur simultaneously. There is Tuma, and there is something else. Meaning to say, what he's saying is the following. The reason why a woman and a man do not have cohabitation while she's in Nida is not because she's Tameya. It is not the factor of Tuma that creates that prohibition. The proof of the pudding is because the greatest level of Tuma is contact with the dead, and contact with the dead doesn't create that prohibition. Meaning, Nida is a curious and difficult example of two simultaneous things happening at once, which are not connected to each other. Meaning, the Tuma of Nida is the same as the Tuma of anything else. Meaning, it is a limited concept that says, you may not enter the Beit HaMikdash. Nida happens to have another aspect that impacts on marital relations, but that does not come from the status of Tuma. That is simply another prohibition. Of course, he doesn't tell us why there is that prohibition. That's going to be a major question, but his point is, it needs to be intellectually disassociated from the concept of Tuma. Now, that itself is important, because sometimes you hear the way people talk, they say, oh, the Nida is impure. Nida is something wrong, and therefore I can't go near there. The Yehuda Levi says, no, the Tuma of the Nida is precisely not the factor that generates the prohibition of husband and wife, because that is not part and parcel of the construct of Tuma. That is, as we say, a chidush. That actually is somewhat of a unique classification. Now again, I'm not sure if it helped people that much, because ultimately he himself does not give us any other explanation for why husbands and wives are not allowed to be intimate. But the one thing he says is the negation. It is not because of the construct of Tuma. There is Tuma of Anida, but that's the same Tuma as would apply to touching a dead body, or anything, you know, you can't go into the temple, etc. And that's because of potential life and the like. But be it as it may, so we mentioned the Tuma of the dead body, the Tuma of the dead animal, the Tuma of seminal emission, the Tuma of Nida. I want to mention one other Tuma. I think I mentioned it last week. I don't remember. That is the Tuma of a woman after childbirth. Right? Just to go over this quickly, and that'll take us to some new material I want to share with you. And that is, the Torah says, when a woman gives birth to a boy, she is Tumeya for 40 days. What does that mean? For 40 days, again, going back to our old limited construct, she may not enter the Beit HaMikdash or eat the korbanot for 40 days. She is Tumeya for 40 days. I'm not talking about when she could be with her husband. I'm talking about the Tumah. The Tumah is for 40 days, after which she brings a sacrifice. If she gives birth to a girl, she is Tumeah for 80 days. Again, I'm not referring to being with her husband. I'm talking about she may not enter the temple for 80 days or eat korbanot. And this is true whether she gives birth to a live child or whether she gives birth, God forbid, to a stillbirth. So the question becomes, in what way could you possibly say a live birth is contact with death? So again, there are two possible explanations. One is that every childbirth is contact with death because it is physically dangerous. And mother and infant mortality was historically very, very high and still somewhat high in many parts of the world. It is a brush with death. It is a brush with death every time it happens. You take it for granted. Maybe the men take it for granted, but in something that is a dangerous experience. If a woman goes into labor on Shabbat, the halakha is very, very clear that the husband is allowed to drive her to the hospital, etc., because it is called pikuach nefesh, saving a life. So that's one reason why there's a tumah there, because it is a contact, at least with a brush with death. The other reason why it's considered to be a death is Rav Shimshon of Elhurst says, because it is a death of the life that was within. There was a life that was within a person's body. That life has ended. There's a new life that's out there. The life within has ended. Therefore, something has died within the woman. Although that death was a greater rebirth, but there was something that was done. Because remember, again, this is a scary, perhaps pessimistic thought, but the beginning of death is actually birth. Right? When a person is born, they are beginning the path. The beginning of separation is birth. Right? I mean, right? As a child grows older and older and older, there is more and more separation from the parents. The child becomes more dependent, independent. We welcome it on one level. Of course we welcome it. But there's also something sad that we don't have that same connection. And this would even be more so when you have a fetus that is growing and being nurtured and is physically part of the body. The birth is that first step of individuation, that first step of autonomy. Right? You don't look at a newborn baby as autonomous, independent creature. But that first step has occurred, the separation from the body. And that's a death of sorts. That's the death of the old total dependence, total connection. And therefore, in a very subtle way, birth is by definition the death of the type of life that existed within. And why is the tumah for the birth of a girl double? Because in every woman, there is her life, and there are the eggs which are in her from even before birth, from whenever there's embryonic development. All of the eggs needed to produce life are there from its inception. And therefore, there's a double life. The girl and the life within her, as opposed to the boy, where sperm is not developed until puberty, until a much older age. In fact, I think I may have mentioned the medical technology where infertile women, or women who do not ovulate, they're actually harvesting eggs from aborted female fetuses and utilizing them in vitro fertilization, transplanting them to women who don't ovulate. Now, a woman, a fetus, an aborted fetus, in the sixth, seventh, or eighth month, they have 1 million eggs. 1 million eggs. And theoretically, therefore, a child, or a fetus, or whatever you want to call it, who was never born, may be a parent to millions and millions of offspring. So, the amazing thing is, a child may have a mother who never existed in the world. No, it's not. I'm not saying this is halakhically practical. It's not science fiction. It absolutely, I'm not sure if it's already being done, it absolutely can be done. The only reason it's not being done is only because it's enmeshed in the abortion debate, pro-life and pro-choice. I mean, there's no technological reason why this cannot be done today. I'm not sure if it's actually being done yet. Well, I understand. I'm not saying these are complete explanations. But again, I do want to emphasize, though, again, it's always important that you keep in mind that these 80-day waits are only a very small limitation on overall activity, meaning you can't go to the temple for 80 days. In other words, one shouldn't perceive of this, oh, you know, you can't go to shul, right? In other words, don't make those translations. Those translations are not accurate. It refers to the Beit HaMikdash and eating korbanot. Now, very often women were not that heavily involved in those activities that much anyway. Okay? Because of Nida? Because of Nida. Well, all right. Well, basically, I guess it comes from the concept. It comes from the concept, though, that that's kind of the burden of being so involved in the creation of life. If the Tuma is the voiding of the potentialities of life, so it is part of the woman's burden that is connected to the woman's bracha, right? The bracha of being, as Chava, Eim Kol Chai, the mother of all life, does create that disadvantage. It's kind of the disadvantage that comes with that great blessing. Just as one might say, you know, pregnancy on one level is described as a curse in the Torah, right? The Chava was cursed. Be'etzev tel di banim, with travail, with pain, with suffering, shall you give birth to your children. You may recall that in the 19th century, when anesthesia was first introduced for women in childbirth, the Catholic Church was against the use of anesthetic because they said this contravened the biblical directive that it's supposed to hurt. It's supposed to hurt. What do you mean you don't want to feel it, right? Now, as you know, of course, all the priests were men, etc. Mm-hmm. Now, as you know, Judaism never accepts that rule. Judaism recognizes that a curse is a description of the reality that exists, but it's not a divine command not to try to make it better. In other words, God created a world in which this will be the normal way things work, but it's certainly part of our job to try to mitigate human misery and human suffering. But nevertheless, we also recognize that along with that curse is the blessing, that Chava is indeed the source of life. So it kind of brings out the idea that with every blessing will also come a certain amount of burden and a certain amount of pain. That the life that we live in is, with blessing, there's going to be pain. In fact, if I could digress on something totally it's related, but nothing to do with our topic, it reminds me of an article I read many years ago in Rolling Stone magazine. Very, very fascinating. Rolling Stone magazine has had, in the 1970s, one of the best articles ever written on the Baal Tshuva movement, the return of Jews to Judaism. It was written by a freelance journalist, Ellen Willis, whose brother came to Israel and became religious. And she was sent by her family to investigate what kind of crazy cult had taken over his mind. And Rolling Stone magazine, I still remember when I was, this was in the 70s, all the rabbis in Chicago wanted to get hold of this magazine. But they were kind of embarrassed to walk into a store and buy a Rolling Stone magazine, which has the drugs and everything else. So one rabbi I know waited until 2 a.m. Saturday night to go into a 7-Eleven to buy the Rolling Stone magazine, figuring that nobody would see him. And of course, the young boy that he had over for his Shabbat guest was there. He says, now I know why you rabbis are so high in Shabbat. I see what you read after Shabbat. But in this article, the woman describes a conversation that she had with Rabbi Noach Weinberg. Rabbi Noach Weinberg, I'm sure many of you know Eishet Torah here in Potomac. Well, Eishet Torah is, of course, an international organization that is centered in Jerusalem. And Rabbi Noach Weinberg is the head of Eishet Torah, teacher here. In fact, his brother was the Rosh Yeshiva of Ner Israel, who died over the past summer, Rav Yaakov Weinberg. But Rav Noach Weinberg, who, if any of you have ever heard him, is a remarkably convincing person, very, very charismatic, very persuasive. I mean, he would make, he would make an absolutely perfect insurance salesman. I mean, you will buy whatever he sells you. And he was engaged in a discussion with this young woman, who was kind of asking, you know, why keep these traditions, etc. And he said, okay, let's have a discussion. He says, what do you think human beings value above all else? So she said, human beings want pleasure in life. And he accepted that. He said, okay, tell me the opposite of pleasure. And she said, the opposite of pleasure is pain. And he said, no, the opposite of pleasure is comfort. So she didn't understand that, because she thought pleasure and comfort are synonyms. They're not opposites. He says, no, pleasure is when you struggle for something important. And by definition, you will get pleasure only if you've also had pain. Because when you struggle and you're invested and you work and you fail, and you don't always, you know, you're not always successful, but you eventually achieve something, that gives you a deep sense of pleasure. Comfort is the decadence of never putting out the effort. So you're comfortable. That's not going to give you pleasure. And this applies even in trivial or less significant. Let's assume that, you know, you have a child who wants to be a good basketball player. So every morning, a child gets up at 6 o'clock and practices 2 hours. You know, and that's hard. You know, you go to sleep late, you get up early. Or these Olympic stars that start at the time they're 9 and a half, you know, and they, you know, they work 8 hours a day at gymnastics or whatever it is. But at the end, there's a certain pleasure because you've struggled for something. Comfort is not getting out of bed. So Ray Weinberg said, people make a big mistake when they confuse comfort with pleasure. Because the real pleasure of life comes with the struggles that we go through. And that's true in marriage, and that's true in raising children, and that's true in job attainments, and that's true in anything, really. If you want to be a basketball player, you know, anything at all. It is the struggle that gives us the joy. And that's why you'll find many successful people will often look back at their lives and they will often say, the happiest time of my life was when I was building something. But then I was, you know, struggling towards a goal. It's very elusive, you know, because sometimes when we set goals, you know, when they say, you better be careful what you ask for because you might get it, that creates the real problem. That sometimes it is the destination, it is the journey that's much more significant than the destination. Now, what is this apropos of? It's not really apropos of anything, but the reason I'm bringing it up is simply it connects somewhat peripherally to your points, and that is, you say women get cheated in both directions, that sometimes it's precisely the struggle that gives the real blessing and the ability to create life. That struggle. In fact, even with children, parents often find, although it's not a warrant to be difficult, the parents often find that the child that they had the most difficult time with is the child that they're the most connected to. Because they just put so much of themselves, they put so much of themselves into that child. Now, you may not know it at the time.
You know that when the pleasure comes.
I had a professor, in Hopkins who was once describing the transition of communist economies to free market economies. So he said, it's not really that bad. It's like rolling over Niagara Falls in a barrel. He says, the beginning and the end is hard. The middle, you know. No, what did he say? The beginning and the end is okay. It's just the transition that's difficult. Makes sense, you know. So it's the transitional years. But, you know, eventually you get to some type of relationship. Okay. But this is the construct of Tuma, right? So we know what Tuma is. Tuma is, just defining our terms, contact with death, directly or indirectly, that leads to separation from the Beit HaMikdash and Korbanot. Now, certain Tumah is 7 days long, certain Tumah is 1 day long. Right? We have differences there. But all Tumah requires purification rituals. You don't become Tahor automatically. You gotta do something. Meaning, if you don't do something, then you're tamei forever and ever and ever. Right? You gotta do something. So for some things you do it after 7 days or during the 7 days, and some things you do it after 1 day. So what are our purification rituals? So here, there are two primary purification rituals in halacha. One is immersion in the mikvah. Mikvah means a gathering of water. and the other are the ashes of the Para Aduma. Now, to be accurate, what are the ashes of Aduma? The Torah says, this is in the book of Numbers, book of Adibar, Parshat Chukat, you take a red cow, red heifer, the reason it's called heifer because it's simply a cow that was not pregnant, it was a heifer. It is slaughtered, it is burnt into ashes. Those ashes are mixed with spring water, and whenever you are tamei because of contact with the dead body, you must be sprinkled with a mixture of those ashes and water on day 3 and on day 7 of your tuma. So if I become tamei on Monday, so day 3 is Wednesday and day 7 is Sunday, and so I'm sprinkled, you don't do it on Shabbat. That's why I said Monday. If you were Sunday, you'd have to delay the 7th day to the 8th day. But needless to say, you're sprinkled on day 3 and day 7. Then on day 7, you go to the mikvah, and the night after day 7, you are now tahor. Okay? Now, in the case of other tumot, which are not connected to the dead, you don't need sprinkling of ashes. You simply need mikvah. In the case of the woman of childbirth, the tumah is a long tumah. 40 days, 80 days, it's much longer than all of the other tumot. Now, if you... The parah adumah is a very strict halacha and a very strange halacha in many ways. The cow has to be totally red. It's allowed to have up to one black hair. But if it has two black hairs, not kosher, can't be used for parah adumah. And you know, every few years there's some excitement in Israel. Someone says, oh, we have a parah adumah.
Right.
And then they discover that one of the hairs turns a wrong color. Of course, you have to have some rabbi decide what's an appropriate shade of red. It's maybe not so simple. Brown, tans, and, you know, there are different types of colors. I mean, red does not mean firehouse red. You know, no cow is a firehouse red color. It's basically a kind of reddish-brown color, right? That already you have difficulties in determining. So it's not even a simple matter. Some want to produce a parah adumah by genetic engineering and the like. But be it as it may, as we know, Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon, who is described as the Chacham Mikol Adam, said he understood the reasons for all the commandments of the Torah, but he didn't understand this one. This one didn't make a lot of sense to him. And this is Chazal apply the Pasuk in Ecclesiastes. Amarti Ech Keman. I thought I would be wise in understanding the Torah. Fihi Rechoka Mimeni. But it is distant from me. I don't understand this one. This one got me stumped. And that's why it is called Zot Chukat HaTorah. This is the law, Chok. Mishpat, what we call Mishpatim, are those commandments for which we understand the reasons. Chok are those decrees which are beyond human comprehension. Now, the commentaries explain, though, if you were to make a list of the difficult commandments to understand, all right, parah adumah might be difficult, but, you know, I can find other ones that are difficult, too. Don't mix wool and linen, etc. Why is this the most difficult? What is uniquely difficult about parah adumah? So the commentaries explain that the thing that stumped King Solomon was not why a red cow, etc. That, you know, God wanted it that way. But he didn't understand the paradox of parah adumah. Parah adumah is contradictory. Why is that so? Because here's the halacha. If I'm tamei and I get sprinkled with the ashes and the water of the parah adumah, I am now tahor, or I will be tahor. I'm not tahor right away, but I'll be tahor after the 7 days. And yet, everybody who handles the ashes themselves become tamei. Meaning, the one who burnt the parah, the one who carried the parah, the ashes of the parah after it was slaughtered, etc. They're all tamei. Now, they're tamei for only one day, and they don't need to be sprinkled with ashes. Otherwise, you'd have an unending circle, because I'm tamei because I handle the ashes. You got to sprinkle me. Now, you're tamei. It doesn't work today, because the circle ends, basically, because those who handle the ashes are tamei for one day, and they just have to go to the mikvah. But they are tamei. Meaning, parah adumah is a vehicle of purification for those who are tamei, but it's a vehicle of contamination for those who are tahor.
From a dead body, why are they not
tamei? Oh, okay. That itself is not a problem. The reason that's not a problem is the parah adumah is shechted. Now, if you recall, the halacha that a dead animal conveys tumah only applies if it did not die through the process of a kosher shechita. That's why a kohen could eat meat. Otherwise, how could a kohen eat meat? It's a dead animal, right? So that's the halacha. The halacha is that the parah adumah is shechted, so it itself would not convey tumah to the one that's sprinkled. But there's another halacha that those who handle it become tameh for one day. So Shlomo HaMelech's problem is, how can the same thing be a vehicle for purity and be a vehicle for impurity? That's what got him stuck. And in the language of Chazal, it's mitamei et ha-tahorim. It contaminates those who are pure, umitaher et ha-tmeyim, and it purifies those who are tamei. Now, of course, if you think about this, that perhaps is not such a paradoxical notion. There are many things in life that could be of great benefit to some and could be of great detriment to others. I don't want to get into specific names, but my Rosh Yeshiva used to describe certain Jewish organizations. He would actually use the language of the parah adumah. He would say, this is very good to uplift people who are in a certain place. Totally. But Shlomo HaMelech felt this was a difficult question. question. Now, obviously, we have to understand that if King Solomon, the wisest of all people, felt this to be an unanswerable paradox, then any explanation we offer is obviously not going to be complete. And nevertheless, notwithstanding this, we do find in later Hasidic books in particular some partial explanation of why this is so. And to understand this, let's go back. We spent a long time talking about Tuma. Let's talk about Tahara. Why does the ashes of the Parah Aduma make me pure? Why does immersion in a mikveh make me pure? How does it undo what Tuma produces? If Tuma produces a certain state, how do these rituals reverse that particular state? So here we have to go back to the very beginning of time. Adam and Eve were originally supposed to live forever. But death came into the world as a result of the sin of eating from the fruit that God said not to eat from. Whether it wasn't an apple, the one thing we know is it wasn't an apple, but the fruit was either wheat, grain, grapes, esrog, you know, there are different opinions, fig, whatever the fruit was, or whatever the food was, it was a violation of God's command. What caused that violation of God's command? Now again, that's a very, very deep question, and one of the students here gave me a very excellent paper on it, but on a simple meaning, Rav Tzadok writes, Rav Tzadok of the Hasidic Rabbis writes, that the sin was the sin of arrogance and kavod, and looking for honor. Because the Nachash told Eve that if you eat from this fruit, you will be like God, knowing in a true, deep sense good and evil. You will understand ultimate reality. You will understand what is good and what is evil. The appeal is, you can be godlike. And it was the arrogance of wanting to be godlike, wanting to be... Again, there are other variations of this. On one hand, they wanted to be the one who defines what is good and evil. Instead of taking God's definition, you will be the definer of good and evil. I mean, there are many different twists on it. But whatever the pitch was, you will be godlike. It was ga'ava. It was arrogance. It was conceit. It was ego that drove Adam and Chava commit that sin of rebelling against God. So the consequence of that rebellion was death. Why is that so? Not so much, Rav Tzadok says, because death is a punishment for sin, but rather, death is the antidote to sin. How is that so? Because if the sin was the arrogance of thinking you can be God, God has to give you a reminder that you're not God. Because in many ways, a human being is like God. We are in the image of God. We have creativity. We have power. We have initiative. We have the ability to control vast portions of the universe. We have the ability to destroy this world. Right? We have a nuclear arsenal that can certainly destroy the whole world. So the human being is always prone to the temptation. And indeed, this is even a greater temptation maybe today, because of technology and so many things that we can do, of forgetting that there is a God and we are just a creation and not a creator. And particularly with cloning and genetic engineering and the like, the division between being a creation and a creator is perilously close to disappearing. God says, death is the ultimate reminder of our fallibility, of our weakness, of our vulnerability, of the fact that we are not God. Death came into the world because of arrogance and conceit in order to remind us to be humble and submissive and recognize our vulnerability and our dependence on Hashem. In that sense, death is considered to be a positive contribution to the human being's psychological perception of his role in the universe. That's why there's a verse in Qohelet that says, better to go to the house of the mourner than to go to the house of the party. Why is that so? Because when we go to the house of the Mordan, we're reminded of our mortality. That arouses within our heart a sense of our dependence on God. And it also gives us a sense of the preciousness of life. This is very important. Imagine if you would live forever. So, you'd never get anything done, because you'd always figure, well, I don't have to do it today, I'll do it 10,000 years from now. You know. The point is, it is precisely the fact that life is not eternal that makes us cherish, or should make us cherish, every minute and every opportunity. That a person can never say, I'll do things later. Because, you know, unfortunately, you know, you see Ann Landers every day, somebody writes a letter, I wish I did something, you know, now it's too late. And, you know, we laugh at these because every day somebody writes a letter. But sadly, it is often, all too often, true that we think there are times to do this and do that, and the time passes. And we never take advantage of those opportunities. Right? So death is an antidote, not a punishment so much. Death is an antidote to the arrogance and complacency that a human being might otherwise have because of their godly natures, their natures which are so godlike in many, many ways. Now, that explains another midrash, an amazing midrash that actually says, you know, for all the days of creation, every time God makes something, it says God saw it was good. At the end of the creation, right before Shabbat comes in, it says God saw everything that he made, v'hinei tov me'od, it is very good. So what's the very good? Every individual thing is only good. What makes 20 goods a very good? So good, 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 good. Overall very good. What's the extra thing? The Midrash says that after God made the world, he added death, although it's difficult, death didn't come into later, but the Midrash says that adding death into the world turned the good into the very good. What's the explanation? The explanation is exactly this, that death creates the capacity for appreciation. And appreciation makes the good into the very good. Okay, now, so based on this, the line therefore is that when death was introduced into the world, thereby showing that man is not God, that also meant expulsion from the Garden of Eden. Because you can no longer occupy God's sacred place. You leave God's sacred place to a world of decay and transience and temporariness. So, if that's what happened on the macrocosmic level, every time a human being is in contact with death, that is a reminder once again of the arrogance that caused death to come into the world. And just like that first arrogance results in the expulsion from the Garden of Eden, so too the reenactment of that contact with death causes a new expulsion from the Garden of Eden, God's sacred place. And God's sacred place is, of course, the temple and the Korbanos. So, arrogance causes death. Death causes expulsion from sacred space. My contact with death, therefore, is a reminder of my arrogance, my gaiva, my conceit, which brought this death into the world. Therefore, I must be banished from the Garden of Eden once again. In other words, in effect, Tuma is a reenactment, a spiritual reenactment of the expulsion of Adam and Eve from the Garden of Eden. Now that's the Tumah side of the coin. Let's look at Tahara. The Sfat Emes says the following. If death comes into the world because of arrogance and conceit, one is liberated from the negativity of death by humility and submission. And therefore the key to understand purification rituals is that they represent a symbolic submission of the human being to God in humility and modesty. That's why ashes. Ashes is a symbol of self-effacement, self-abnegation. Right? You make yourself like ashes. When Abraham prays for Sodom, Abraham says to God, I am dust and I am ashes. So sprinkling yourself with ashes is symbolically turning yourself into ashes. So from that, like the phoenix, right? The phoenix, the bird of Greek mythology that rises from the ashes. That's exactly the concept here. Make yourself ashes. Leave the arrogance. Leave the conceit. Leave the hubris. And from that you achieve renewal, rebirth, recreation. You have rectified that which caused death to come into the world, which was arrogance and conceit. You have rectified that arrogance. Therefore, you are at least momentarily, of course, there's still death in the world, but in terms of your personality, you have become liberated from the banishment and estrangement that death represents. And therefore, you have become pure. You have become reborn. So the key to the paradigm, this doesn't explain everything. This does not explain why a red heifer. But we're not looking at colors, but we're looking at the concept of the ashes. That the ashes is an antidote to my arrogance, and it liberates me from the tuma of death, and it gives me tahara. Now, a mikvah can be understood in much of the same way. And mikvah perhaps is even more relevant to us, because mikvah is still a ritual that is practiced today. The mikvah is a symbol of rebirth. Many people have pointed out that the mikvah is designed to be a womb-like experience. Right? The baby in the womb is surrounded by water. You immerse in the mikvah. But you have to understand that in that sense, the mikvah is a death experience in and of itself. Because you put yourself under the water. You are putting yourself in an environment where you cannot live. In effect, therefore, the old self is killed. It is self-effacement, self-abnegation, self-annihilation. The ultimate expression of humility, submission, recognizing, I have no life without Hashem. And then you are reborn. So the concept of all of these ideas are, in fact, is even to go a little further, Kabbalistically, a mikvah must contain a certain volume of water. The volume of water is expressed in halakha as 40 sa'ah, 40 measures of water, which translates in contemporary measurements to approximately 200 gallons of water. Our mikvahs are much larger, but the minimum mikvah is 200 gallons of water. But let's focus on the halakha that talks about 40. Now, this is a bit of a mystical point, but I hope you can bear with me. 40 is symbolically the language, the number that is utilized for the creation of new worlds. We are told, for example, that a pregnancy is not considered it's not considered a fetus until the 40th day, meaning if an abortion is somehow necessary, halakha does permit things to occur within 40 days of conception that it would not allow after 40 days. Creation of potential life is connected to 40. That is why the days that Moshe was on Mount Sinai were always 40 days, because God was creating a new relationship with the Jewish people. That is why the flood was 40 days of rain, because God is destroying the old world but creating a new world with Noah. 40 is connected with creation. Now, why is 40 connected with creation? That's a little more complicated. Pirkei Avot says that God made this world by 10 declarations. 10 times God said, let there be, let there be, let there be. And the Kabbalah teaches there are 4 different levels of worlds. So if each level of world is created in 10 statements, 40 is the totality of the divine creative process. By the way, that's why Shabbat, the number of melachot you cannot do at Shabbat is 39. Because the concept is, out of God's 40 levels of creation, human beings can do 39 of them. But there's one level of creation that only God can do, and that's creating something out of nothing. God has the 40th level of creation. The other 39 levels we have a connection to. Be it as it may, the point, therefore, is this. If mikvah connotes destruction of the old and recreation of the new, and if 40 is connected to creation, then ideally, in order to be recreated, you ought to stay in the mikvah for 40 days. Now, that's not feasible. You can't be in the mikvah for 40 days. So, in effect, what the halakha did was, the halakha took a number that is significant in terms of a time dimension, and converted it into a space dimension. So we take, instead of 40 days, we make it a volume of 40 sa'ah. But the concept is recreation. And that is why mikvah is not only for women who are nidot, it also applies to a convert, a Jew who wants to become, a non-Jew who wants to become Jewish. It's a new birth. And it even applies to dishes. If you buy dishes that you're going to use in a Jewish kitchen, those dishes are being dedicated to a higher holy purpose. Therefore, they must undergo a conversion. Right? Literally, you are converting your dishes to Judaism. And that's one way you could understand. There's no Brit Milah that's necessary for a dish or a pot, but it must be immersed in a mikvah. So you see, so let's summarize with you, because this is a little bit of a complicated thing here. But the concept is the following. Tumah comes from death. Death comes from arrogance. Therefore, we are liberated from death and its consequences by humility and submission that rectifies and cures the arrogance that brought death into the world. And therefore, the purpose of purification rituals are to connote submission and dependence to God, curing the arrogance that created that death in the first place. This is exemplified by the para aduma, which are ashes, and the mikvah, which is self-annihilation, putting yourself in the water. Both of them are, you are rising from destroying the old self, which was arrogant and haughty, and becoming the new self. Now, as is true for all symbols, this does not necessarily mean that the worshipper is consciously aware of this process. In other words, let's assume you went to the mikvah and you didn't have this thought in mind. Is it still a valid immersion? Yes, it's a valid immersion. If I'm sprinkled with the ashes of the para aduma and I'm still haughty and arrogant, have I become tahor? I have become tahor. Meaning, to some extent, the ritual gets an independent validity in irrespective of the subjective mindset of the worshipper. That's always the case. But if we're focusing on the ultimate values, the ultimate meanings that the Torah is trying to convey by these rituals, they are primarily exercises in the subjective awareness of a person. A person becomes transformed, or should become transformed, by these externalities. Yeah.
Yes. That's the purpose of the action.
Yes, that's 100% correct. The only point I'm making is that may be the purpose, but the validity does not depend on the purpose being achieved. Because according to halakha, even if I pushed you into the mikvah, you're going to be pure.
Can one deduce from one of these words that someone goes through this activity?
Oh, okay. So that gets us into... Okay, this of course gets us into the famous discussion of Reb Chaim of Volozhin in Nefesh HaChayim. In other words, the philosopher's attitude is, if mitzvot are designed to achieve certain mental and spiritual transformations within us, what if I could achieve the mental transformation without the action? Right? Is there a need? One theoretically could make such an argument, but once again, any meaning we give is only an infinite fraction of possible meanings. And in no way, I mean, that's like a person who says, to give you an absurd example, let's say a person says, well, the purpose of a Seder is to remember that God took us out of Egypt and appreciate that. Well, I can appreciate it without having a Seder. Or, I'm so tired, if I make a Seder a week from Passover, it'll be much more inspiring. I mean, that's really the issue of, you know, if I simply look at mitzvot as means to spiritual excitement and experience, you could get rid of all of halakha that particular way. And that's the old concept, really, chassidut and misnagdin. Do I emphasize the inner experience or the others? Although it's interesting that Maimonides is not identified as, well, this is before chassidut anyway, but we would normally not identify him with the chassidic way, is emphasizing the inner experience there.
So, the role of Mayim water.
Yeah.
Right. Why is it? Does God particularly choose Mayim because water cannot be brought down into the Jordan? So some of the
Well, water seems to be chosen because water is the biological source of all life, meaning all living things. We are what, 90% water? We're 70, right, okay. But you know, we are mainly water. I remember when I was in school, probably inflation is much more, but they used to say that chemicals, we're worth only like $3.90, if you break us down to chemicals. And most of that is water. So water is the shorish of all life. It is, in fact, the word mayim comes from ma. What is it? It's the ultimate substance of things. And therefore that's a symbol of rebirth and renewal and everything else. So you see the correlation. The correlation here is arrogance breeds death. Death breeds banishment, which is tuma. Purification breeds humility. Humility liberates us from death. Humility terminates the banishment. Therefore, we are able to rejoin the temple and the sacred space. We are readmitted, as it were, to Gan Eden, to the Garden of Eden on this earth, the sacred relationship with God. Now, based on this, I think the Sfat Emet and other Hasidic works say perhaps we have a partial understanding to Shlomo HaMelech's paradox. The paradox of Parah Adumah was, once again, how can the same thing purify and contaminate? Well, the answer might be very simple. If the Parah Adumah is a symbol of humility, submission, and self-annihilation, there is a good way that that can go, and there's a bad way that that can go. Meaning, humility can be defined in many, many ways. There is the humility of a person have a sense of their worthlessness, their uselessness, the fact that they consider themselves a failure with no abilities. That's a very destructive quality. That is not a good quality to have. Because when a person is so consumed with their inadequacies and their failures that they feel that there's no chance they could ever be constructive and useful in life, that is really a yetzer hara, that is an evil inclination within a person that destroys the possibilities of tshuva, of repentance, because after all, if I'm so far gone, what's the use? That destroys the abilities of constructive change, that destroys a person's ability to rise to an occasion with courage and with strength, and therefore it's a very, very destructive thing. But there's another type of humility, which is not a humility of paralysis and despair, but a humility where one honestly recognizes their talents and their gifts, but uses those talents and gifts not as a matter of ego stroking, but uses them in a constructive and good way. And that becomes very empowering. In other words, people have to understand that we sometimes have a sense of humility as creating shyness, reticence, and passivity. In reality, humility can be an amazingly empowering, to use a politically correct term, phenomenon. How is this? Because very, very often, one of the things that paralyze us from going forward in life spiritually is a fear of failing. We don't want to start something. We don't want to do something. Because what if we fail? Now, the Baal Gava, the arrogant person, lives and dies based on the approbation of the crowd. What will people say about me? What will they think about me? I am afraid to look bad in someone else's eyes. And therefore, I'm not gonna take a certain step. I'm not going to say hello to somebody, because what if they don't receive me properly, right? Sometimes a new face comes in a synagogue, and you know, you want to go over, make them welcome. But one of the things we think about is, what if they don't respond well to me? I'm going to be humiliated. I'm going to be embarrassed. And sometimes that happens, right? You might greet somebody, and somebody's just unfriendly to you. And then a person might think, I'm never going to do that again. I'm not going to let myself be embarrassed again. But you see, if one has the humility in a positive way, the only issue becomes, what's the right thing to do? What's the good thing to do? And you know, if they accept me, that's wonderful. And if they don't, I did a good thing anyway. So humility is very empowering, because you're not at the beck and call of how people respond to you. Now, that doesn't mean you specifically go out of your way to antagonize people. That obviously is not the case. But we mean that your responses are conditioned by what needs to be done, and not by what will people say and how will people react. And that's a very, very liberating thing to be able to do. One of the great rabbis once said, A human being should never ask if something can be done or not. A human being can only ask, should something be done? If should something be done, you got to try to do it, even if you think it's impossible or whatever it is. Can or cannot is up to God. Should or should not is up to me, because God says I have to make the choices as to what is the best way. God does not always give me a clear answer. I have to think about what halakha requires, etc. But once it is decided that something is the right thing to do, you got to go ahead and try it, even if you may fail, because it's not up to us to try. But again, one who is so fragile that they depend on the crowd will be paralyzed in many ways. The arrogant person might be the most insecure person of all, because they need a constant kind of ego stroking, a constant sense of applause, a constant sense of getting validation, because there's no validation that's coming from within. See? So in a sense, this might be the lesson of Parah Aduma. The quality of self-abnegation, which is such a powerful quality that can purify you and give you rebirth and empowerment and closeness to God, if you take it in the wrong direction and you take it as lack of worth, lack of importance, paralysis and passivity, can make you tougher. Because the Torah is actually telling us, beware of the fact that something which is fundamentally good is very easily prone to a distortion, which will then become fundamentally destructive. And this is really the paradox. Now, this is the famous statement of the Hasidic Rebbe, Rav Bunim of Preshiska. I'm sure all of you have heard this, that a person has to have two ideas in his pockets at all times. One is, I am dust and ashes, I am nothing. And the other is, Bishvili Nivra Ha'olam, because of me, the world was created. You see, this is exactly the point. If all you have is the notion, I'm nothing, I'm worthless, then what you have is a person who never realizes the potential that is within, who doesn't become a vehicle for goodness in the world, because they feel they have nothing to contribute. So it has to be balanced with the sense, I am important, right? The old, like that t-shirt, that cute t-shirt. God does not make junk. Have you seen that? I don't think still, I remember. But I remember years ago that there's a thing, a lot of inner city kiddies were wearing, that God does not make junk. That's a tremendous, tremendous idea. That a human being has potential and abilities and talents, and they make a difference, and they're worthwhile. That's Bishvili, because of one human being was the world created. God didn't create many humans. God started with one to show that every human being justifies the whole world, even if there's just one. But, on the other hand, if you suffer from an overdose of Bishvili Nivra Ha'olam, that's not counterbalanced by that humility, then you have arrogance and contempt for others. And contempt for others ultimately leads to contempt for God, and therefore it needs to be counterbalanced with humility. And this, of course, is a vital lesson to all of us, but it's a vital lesson particularly to raising children, and if you have children as students, in which a child must have a sense of their value, of their importance, of their abilities. They must be treasured and appreciated for what they are, even if it's not some idealized image that a parent would have. And at the same time, not to be arrogant and disparaging of others. You know, this story about how that might be the Parah Aduma. So in a way, as I say, Shlomo HaMelech said this was an unanswerable question, so I assume it is unanswerable. But a partial understanding might be that if the Parah Aduma is a symbol of humility, it can be a good thing if taken in one way. It can be a bad and destructive thing if it's taken in the other direction. They do tell the story, though, that sometimes there is a concept of getting pride in one's humility. One might actually be so proud how humble they are. They tell a story, this might be an apocryphal story, about two yeshiva students who were sitting on a train before Rosh Hashanah, which is a kind of introspection and serious reflection. And each one was talking about how lowly they are. One boy was saying, oh, I am nothing, I have so many sins, so many avirot, and I haven't done what my life is about, etc. And he starts sobbing and crying, and there's no one as bad as me in the world. And the other boy says, no, I'm worse, there's no one as bad as me, I have so many avirot, and how will I do tshuva? So in front of them, there was a simple gentleman who was hearing these two budding scholars who are crying and weeping over their sins. He says, he was a very sincere person. He says, these boys feel they haven't kept the mitzvot. You know, I'm even worse. And he starts sobbing louder and louder than both of them. So they turn around to him in a somewhat of a disparaging tone and says, look who thinks he's nothing. Meaning, you know. So that's kind of an expression where sometimes you get your pride in your humility and modesty, and you get offended when somebody's more modest than you. You know, because that's taking away the spotlight. So you have to be careful. These are all sorts of psychological issues here. But the point is that a Torah personality, the way a Jewish personality, is not one who thinks of himself or herself as inadequate, poor, untalented. Rather, a person must have an awareness of the tremendous range of gifts that Hashem has given us. And only with that awareness are those gifts going to be used in a proper way. But the arrogance shouldn't be there, because one knows that these are gifts that Hashem has given us. One knows that with gifts come responsibilities. And one knows that every other human being also has gifts and talents that should be cherished and respected, and therefore there's no concept of looking down at anybody. And that's why I've said many times that any Jewish education that involves any disparagement of other religions or other races is absolutely a non-kosher methodology of chinuch. Unfortunately, it sometimes craps through. But the concept of human beings are in the image of God applies to non-Jews as well. Okay, granted, the Kuzari talked about a different type of neshama, but that's not a contradiction. There are different levels of neshama. That might be true. But whatever it means to be in the image of God in a general sense applies to Jews and non-Jews, because that goes back to Adam, but that's not limited to Jew. I'm sorry.
In regard to the person in the corner being higher, that comes from that, is that because he's acting like God is giving life, and therefore...
I think that might be a very good possibility, that perhaps when the Kohen is restoring the person to Gan Eden, Kodem HaChetz, perhaps the Kohen has to go purification ritual. That might be a very excellent addendum to that, why the Kohen himself becomes tough. Okay, what time do you have? I think if I could just finish off this topic, I don't think we have time for a totally new topic. Let's see if I have anything else about the notion of Tuma. Yeah, just to remind people that the truth of the matter is, this time of year, not so much this time of year, but in a month or so, you know, we do have, this year is a leap year, so things are a little unusual. But normally in the month of Adar, we do have four special Shabbatot, four special Sabbaths that precede Pesach. And one of them is the Parsha about giving the half shekel. And the other is the parsha before Purim that talks about the eradication of Amalek. And the third is actually Parshat Parah, that is the parsha about the Parah Aduma. And the fourth are the laws of the Korban Pesach. So the sequence basically is that when Jews got ready to bring the Korban Pesach, they had to get purified with the ashes of the Parah Aduma. So consequently, we'll actually be reading about it in around a month or so. In terms of this particular thing. But as I say,